This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hi, I'm Helen Farmer. Great to have you with us on the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. We were looking at children's health, parenting and education on this show. How much screen time should kids get every day? We were speaking to Nazneen Yazan of Fabula Toys, who's against the use of devices for under fives. And we're also getting advice on how to draft a screen time policy with Barry Lee Cummings of Beat the Cyberbully. And for the first time in a long time, we had a guest live in the studio. Dr. Haroon Mann, trauma and orthopaedic surgeon, was answering all of your questions, including, are trampolines really bad news for your kids? And marking Down Syndrome Awareness Month. Parents and son, Wada, Nasser and Dahi, were on air to educate society about the condition that Dahi has. And John Nolan, SEN coordinator at iCademy, was sharing how we can support children with Down Syndrome by teaching them differently.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Come on, be honest. Confession time. How much screen time do you allow your children? Is it possible to have zero screen time during the week? And what should, do you believe, should be the minimum age for using some of the devices? Any parent, myself included right now, is grappling with these topics, trying to get our head around what's right for us, what's right for our kids, where that balance is between keeping them occupied and our sanity, making sure they're not going to be left behind at school. But equally, they're not going to have square eyes and have to be, you know, wrenched iPads out of their little claw-like grip. YouGov just earlier this year found that 31% of children between the ages of 0 and 6 here in the UAE own their own mobile device. It's an alarmingly high rate. In fact, another study by Norton says that children in the UAE are amongst the youngest to own their first mobile phone. One mum that's very vocal about this and not giving any child under the age of 5 advice is joining us on the line now. Nazneen Yazan is here, the founder of Fabula Toys. Thank you so much for joining us, Nazneen. How are you?
Good, thank you, Helen. Really excited to be talking about a topic that's so close to my heart.
Tell us a little bit about your family life. You're a London-based mum. You were here in the UAE. What kids are residing under your roof rent-free right now?
Right. I have one daughter. She's 4 at the moment. She's going to turn 5 in Christmas this year. So you can imagine that kind of age where there's a lot of conversations about any decision. So it's obviously not just a parent deciding anything for her anymore. Mm-hmm. It's a combined discussion, and which is also why topics like screen time are so relevant, because it's not just about me deciding, well, that's it for you for screen. She's got to agree to it. And so you've got to kind of find that logical platform that works both for the parent and for the child.
So what have you put in place in your home, Nazneen? What are some of your rules or guidelines around screen time?
Right. So apart from any school-related work, for pleasure, we've only got, so she doesn't get any sort of screen time during the week. But on Friday evenings to sort of kick off the weekend, she gets two to two and a half hours of screen time. So that's the only screen time she gets the entire week, which my daughter Ira is aware of and she looks forward to for the entire week. So we don't have sort of, I think having a routine is quite beneficial in this process, because then children know what to expect. Mm-hmm. It's not a case of a daily conversation wondering whether she's going to get screen time or not. We clearly know that it's a Friday evening thing, and that just makes Friday just that bit more special, I suppose, for her and for me. It gives me free time as well. So yeah, so that's sort of the equation we have at home at the moment.
And when you say screen time, are you talking about television or movies or iPad devices? What's your kind of definition?
So she doesn't have her own iPad. I still think she's quite young to have her own device. We have a family iPad, and then we've obviously got the television. So depending on what she feels like, I would have to say that more often than not, she chooses the iPad simply because, and you know, I'm happy to kind of elaborate on that later on, but one of the things that really attracts children to screen time is the sense of control they feel. Mm-hmm. Because very often children don't get to decide what they're wearing or what they're having for dinner or where they're going. A lot of those decisions are decided by grown-ups. And therefore, being able to kind of pause and play and skip and move to a new video. That kind of excites young children because it's a huge sense of 100% control. So I'm very conscious of the fact that that is something that she really enjoys, that she likes to take control with the TV that is limited. Mm-hmm. With an iPad, it's a lot more her own world.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
No devices for under fives is the battle cry of Nazneen Yassin. She's the founder of Fabula Toys. Going to the text line and Facebook comments as well, let us know how much screen time happens in your household. What rules are in place? Vic saying at least 2 hours a day. Jay saying no screen time, but how about outside time? Why not promote this? And Julie, great message and a quote I think we can all learn from in all aspects, saying it has to be a collaborative decision. I love the quote from B. Franklin saying, tell me and I forget, teach me and I remember, involve me and I learn, to help our children recognise when they need to turn off the screen. Nazneen, I'd love the idea of my children, you know, playing outside all day, every day, and playing with dollies and cars and things. However, it's just not realistic, to be honest, because I've got to get things done. And also, I feel like, in honesty, they do get an awful lot from some programs and interactive games. And yes, there's some absolute dross out there, and it's no accident that in our household I call YouTube rubbish. So the girls will say, Mummy, can I watch some rubbish? That Deanna girl, I would merrily never see her face again. But do you think there can be good screen time and so-called bad screen time?
Yes, I would probably categorize that slightly differently, if I may. So instead of saying good and bad, I would probably have it as necessary and then bad, and then lots of gray in the middle. And I'll explain that in detail. So necessary is things like, for most expat families, speaking to family abroad, wherever they live, right? So that's screen time, but that is something that they need. Stay in touch with family, to know your roots, in situations like lockdowns, to celebrate your birthday again. So that sort of screen time is actually necessary. You do need to do that. Things like education. Some schools and nurseries, because again, I'm focusing in the 0 to 5 sort of age group, schools and nurseries did do some academic work online. They're still continuing to do some work online. And that's great too. Again, that is necessary and we can't be stopping that. And then there's the bad, which is very clearly things that we know we don't want to do. Things like too much screen time. This is very much about parents. I think I come from a point of view where I don't want to penalize the parent for taking the decision they're taking, because everyone's situation is different. But as long as they've kind of put in some amount of thought before they've taken the decision, I think that's what we're talking about. So you need to know what too much is. The government or organizations such as WHO, or the research from YouGov and Norton that you talked about, can only tell you what is the result of the research that we've done, right? But at the end of the day, the parent needs to decide, yes, a child watching 4 or 5 hours of screen time, we know is too much. Are you comfortable with that? Things like passive watching, and I think most of us have kind of seen our children do that. When they're watching it, their eyes kind of gloss over. You can tell that it's very passive watching. At that point, they're just kind of watching the moving images instead of engaging with the story or using their imagination. And there's a very simple test for that. If a very young child can tell you an entire rhyme, which they've learned off YouTube, let's say, by heart, without being able to tell you what the words mean or who the characters are or how the story was progressing, that just shows that it's passive watching. It's not engaged watching. And that's not going to help your child in any way. And another thing that I'm quite passionate about is, as a parent, you need to be aware of what your child is watching.
Oh, definitely agree with this. Definitely.
My daughter, for example, watches YouTube Kids, which is the only app we have available on the iPad. And even with YouTube Kids, sometimes there is content that maybe isn't right for her age, or I'm just, as a parent, haven't approached it yet, and I'm not sure I want to talk about those things just now. For example, some sort of, you know, teenage characters having crushes or having heartbreaks, which might be difficult topics for a 4-year-old to understand at this point. And which is why I think, as a parent, being aware of what your child is watching, or if you can't be involved with them, because it's not possible in reality to be sitting beside your child while they're watching something, to talk about it later on. in the same way that most of us as parents have talked to our children about COVID, we've kind of simplified the idea. We've talked about, you know, there's germs in the world and we've got to keep ourselves clean and why we can't go visit grandparents this year. Just the same way we can have a conversation about what they're watching. They feel more like that you are involved in what they're watching and what their interests are as well, which also helps in bonding through screen time. So that is possible. But these are a few small tips that make screen time good. And that's a very loose topic. Again, like I said, there's a huge spectrum of gray, and I think parents need to decide for themselves.
I think that's exactly right. There's never a definitive answer. There's never a one size fits all for every single family out there. We're all doing our best and trying to navigate parenting through our own kind of experiences. So I think a big part of it is, if you are worried about it, then, you know, educate yourself, and you can find some great resources on your website, Nazneen. But the fact that if you are worrying about it, then you're probably a really good parent. And the fact that you are, you know, tuning in today is a choice and choosing to understand more, I think, is fantastic. Nazneen, that's all we've got time for today. As I said, you are from Fabula Toys, and you can find out more about some of the non-screen alternatives over on that website. We are
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
How much screen time is okay by you in your household for your kids? Apparently, we all need to limit it. It is easier said than done, especially over the course of the last year and a half, when I know my own screen time went up by, I don't even want to know the numbers. I would just dismiss that notification, to be completely honest. But what about our kids? Lots of you getting in touch saying what's, you know, your kind of rules are, but also we're taking your questions too. Anil saying 30 minutes a day, weekend is movie time, about an hour and a half, all on the TV, but no iPad or phone. Vic says about 2 hours a day, and no name on this message. And as I said, it's absolutely fine to be anonymous. Really don't mind a bit. Saying, what about kids who are 10? We've had a good agreement before COVID started. Kids have their iPads for school all the time, but now it's usually I'll check when the teacher applies and then they go and do other things. Yes, this is the problem we had in ours, when there were school-based activities on YouTube, and next thing I know, they're watching Lego food turn into real food.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking tech this afternoon, trying to limit our own screen time, but also make sure our kids aren't getting too much. But what is too much? Barry Lee Cummings is joining us, the founder of Beat the Cyberbully, to help me put my own screen time policy in place for me and my family. Barry, I'm not going to lie. Screen time, bribery and empty threats are the cornerstones of my parenting. So I'm concerned.
Understandable.
Lots of people getting in touch, sharing how much screen time is A-OK in their household, from 0 up to 4 or 5 hours a day. And again, this isn't about passing judgment. We're really just curious, because we're all just doing our best as parents to try and get through the day. And I think Nazneen's point earlier about there being productive and necessary screen time is a really valid one. But limiting screen time can very much make us the unpopular parent, and no one likes being that one. How old do you think kids need to be before we start having this conversation? And as I say, kind of putting those hard rules in place can feel uncomfortable for us as parents sometimes, and it can often result in a bit of a backlash and increased desirability for those devices from our kids' part. So how do we start that chat?
Yeah, it's a great question. And from my personal opinion, it's as early as possible. And I know there's a lot of discussion around, you know, should we be talking to our children at 4 or 5 years old? Should they have access to screens? Ideally, no. But the reality is, yes, they're going to. They're going to have access to it, either for some schools. You know, I've been into a couple of nurseries when my two were at nursery age, and there's iPad stations in there. So the younger that we start talking to them about these things, the more that it becomes common conversation topics, and then hopefully we can build that kind of open communication channel to be able to have some of those harder scenarios unfolding. But we can do that together as a family, because unfortunately what tends to happen is it becomes very much them and us. Mm-hmm. And as you said, we become the enemy because we're so unfair and we're taking away this, and it's, you don't understand it. This is the world that we live in. And to a certain extent, they have a point, because it is the world they live in, and it is a digital world, and it's not one that we as mom and dad are particularly familiar with. We definitely didn't grow up with it, so we can't fall back on that to really say, yeah, I get what you're saying. So we want to start having these conversations as early as possible, but then we want to also start to put certain parameters in place, and that million-dollar question, you know, how much screen time is too much screen time, is a really objective one and subjective one, because every 8-year-old is different, every 10-year-old is different, every family unit is different, and we have to adapt our approach to this to our family unit, to our children, and also very importantly to ourselves as mum and dad. Yes. And this is where the acceptable use policy comes in, because this is something that we do together. It's not about these are the rules for you kids and off you go, and if you break them there's going to be punishments. It's more a case of, okay, well, let's approach this as a family and make this something that we can A, talk about together, which is just so important, and B, that there will be rules in place for mum and dad as well that we as mum and dad will agree to, and will also abide by the consequences of breaking those rules, so that we really do start walking the walk, as this is us as a family, mm-hmm. looking at a safer online experience, not mum and dad trying to make your life difficult as children.
That makes sense. That makes an awful lot of sense. So rather than us going through, you know, the age brackets about, you know, if you're under 5, then you should have half an hour a day. It, as you say, it's kind of immaterial, to be honest. I'd rather focus, if it's all right with you, on what you term as digital wellness, and that being something that we can work on as a family. What are some of your suggestions on making sure that people are on the same digital page, same web page, when it comes to what's cool with us as a family? So you've talked about, you know, turning off certain functions, limiting notifications. What actually practically can we do, Barry?
Yeah, so I think one of the really good ones, especially for our children that are maybe in the younger age group and they're watching things on Netflix and so forth, is to go into the settings and turn off the autoplay function, so that it doesn't just automatically jump into the next episode of whatever their program of choice is. It actually stops. And again, if you're like mine are 4 and 2, so they're watching Paw Patrol, and they would watch Paw Patrol all day every day if we allowed them to.
Same.
If you don't let them just continually roll through it, and they have to come and actually ask to watch the next one, A, you can keep a count of the time and also the number of episodes that they've been watching, because it's very easy for, oh, we just want one, dad, and suddenly
Barry,
episodes later
this
like,
is our household. I'll be like, show me how much is left, and they'll say there's 4 minutes. I'm like, great, okay, I'll go grab my bag, grab my water, when this one's over we'll go. And sure enough, if I'm 30 seconds over that 4 minutes, they're into the next one, they're emotionally invested, and there's tantrums when I try and get them off the sofa. So is that quite a simple thing to do in Netflix, for example, turning off the autoplay? I need this for me as well, by the way.
Absolutely. And this is the thing that I learned by doing it, because I thought, well, okay, do we have to do it across everybody's profiles? And so if you set up profiles for your children and for you and for your husband or wife, and you all have individual profiles, each profile can have that setting in place. So if you want to turn it off, you can binge whatever, you know, series you're watching at that time. But for the kids' profiles, you can tick the box in the settings that takes away that feature, so that they can watch one episode at a time. And that's one way of limiting the the scenarios that unfold where suddenly you're thinking, hang on a minute, I'm sure they said one episode, and one episode of this is 20 minutes, mm-hmm. and looking at my watch, that's an hour that's disappeared, and that's an hour of screen time. And again, people say, well, is it screen time because it's TV? But a lot of children are watching Netflix on their iPad or their smart device, and not necessarily on an actual TV. And it then comes into this conversation, as you said, that the reality is the world that our children are growing up in is a digital one that involves a lot of screens. Any way that we can balance that screen time use is a good thing, but we also need to focus more about what they're doing on those screens.
Absolutely.
Because they are going to be utilizing them.
I saw a great meme the other day, and it was basically saying we spend our lives watching a medium-sized screen only to go home in front of a bigger screen while holding a smaller screen. I was like, oh, you... Mm-hmm. And then I go to bed and look at another screen. And as you say, this is part of the world. Short of us, you know, throwing our devices in the sea and you know, running away to live in a log cabin, it's just something we need to navigate. There's no black or white. It's shades of grey and doing what we feel comfortable with. But I also I think it's really important that we don't demonise screen time, because as I've said, whether it is through language or game playing, there's a huge amount to be gained by it. It really is. But I think, as you alluded to earlier, it's about us as parents knowing what our kids are doing and having conversations around it, because it can be an opportunity to come together and play a game together or watch a movie together. So what about these kind of family digital times, perhaps?
Yeah, so this is a great one in terms of actually dedicating time to being online together as a family. And like you say, you can decide to watch a movie together or binge some episodes of an appropriately aged series on Netflix, or you can play a game, because this is really, really important. You made such a valid point there, not to demonize the screen and being on there, because there's so many useful apps and websites out there that can help our children and us when it comes to learning, developing skills, and we can start to be more aware of that, and then we can actually put the parameters in place to allow our family unit to use the technology for all these positive things. Because let's say your child is learning the flute, for example, you and they were really enthusiastic about it and wanted to learn more than the allocated whatever time you've given them to have access to a screen. Is that, well, if they were willing to invest more time and that they were actually doing the lessons for learning that musical instrument, you can leave those kind of apps on all the time, so that if your child is saying, you know what, I want to practice more on that, you'd say, well, okay, well, I don't really have a problem with that. It's not about you've gone over your screen time. It's that you actively, proactively want to do something that we as a family deem positive. So, okay, let's leave some of these educational apps in the always on section, but then we can apply settings to some of those other ones where we know for a fact that they're just going to be either wasting time rather than investing time, or they're potentially getting themselves into trouble in some of the social media, some of the chat apps and so forth. And we can start to put parameters in place around those in terms of usage, even to the point where some families are saying, you know what, let's allocate an hour to family online time. And you show me Snapchat, show me Instagram, show me TikTok, and let's TikTok together and see what it is, what it's all about.
Let's become a whole family of influencers and make $1 million. No, but absolutely, because it has to, these kids know, you know, far more than many of us do across many of the platforms. And that, you know, unfortunately, when that gap gets bigger, that's where, you know, it's where predators can lie and, you know, kind of take advantage of that ignorance and that silence. You've got some really great advice on the website about tips of digital wellness, talking about reminding teens how tech companies make money. You know, they're not here for the jollies and the health. Also in terms of signs of unhealthy behaviour. But while I've got you, I want to pick your brains a little bit and hopefully help other people out today about putting together that screen time policy, that agreement with our family. Where do we begin, Barry?
So, yeah, it's a great one. The acceptable use policy is something that we've adapted from the commercial world for social media use when you're employed by a company. You know, you're not allowed to do certain things on behalf of that brand. Well, now we're talking about what we can and can't do within our family unit. And the best place to start is to have an open discussion about what do we have in place already. And it's okay if that discussion is really short, because the answer to that question is nothing. Well, great. That's where we're starting from. There's nothing in place. And that's why we're sitting down to have this conversation, because as a family, we realize there should be some things in place to help prevent us from spending 8 hours just scrolling through Snap or TikTok. We should have breaks. We should have an idea of what we are allowed to do as children in this family, and what mum and dad are also going to agree to in terms of online usage, because it's actually one of the really, really integral parts of this that you alluded to earlier, is that whilst we do go from looking at a laptop or a desktop to then looking at a mobile or a tablet, and then the last thing we do is looking at our phone at night, we actually have to start to change our own behavior to show our children that we are not being hypocritical in this particular scenario, and that we are going to put these in place as well. So we have to establish a baseline. What do we have in place at the moment? Are there any rules, and what are they? It's also a really good time to then understand that if you as a parent think you have put rules in place, when your children sit there and say, well, there aren't any, then we've obviously got a disconnect in terms of
what. Well, that's what I was going to ask you about implementation. You know, how do we send that message to our children and maybe our partners and maybe ourselves that this is a serious agreement that needs to be followed and followed through?
Yeah, and it's even things like the simplest one I can give is that once we've established the baseline, is also the one that we can put on there that everyone can abide by, is that nobody will take a device to the bedroom, that all of the smart devices will stay downstairs or in a communal area in the kitchen or the living room or by the front door on a charging station from a specific time at night until a specific time in the morning. And that's where those devices will stay, because it's showing our children that we are not going to be on them after a certain period of time as well. And again, we can stipulate that if they're going to bed at 6:30, then theirs going on at a certain time and ours are going on there at 9:30, 10 o'clock, or whatever time fits you. And it's something that people say, oh, that's not realistic. But I know quite a few people who have started to put the device outside the bedroom and are sleeping better themselves. And so it's one of those things that we have to lead by example, and we have to do things to show our children, not just telling them, is say, look, I am doing this as well. My smartphone is not going into the bedroom with me. It's staying here. And at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning, again, whatever agree time is, we're allowed to go back on them to do whatever it is. And so these are the kind of things that we can ask our children to give their input on as well, because they'll say, oh, that's not fair. And I need it as an alarm, and I want to read on this. And all of the arguments that they give, we can come up with an alternative as a parent. Alarm clock, here's a book. All of these kind of things that can be given to them, because actually reading the book on these devices is not really good for them either, in terms of the natural rhythm of the body to start shutting down and melatonin to be developed. We have to try to, as much as we're living in a digital age, also realize the impact it's having on our own health.
Absolutely.
And how, if we demonstrate that to our children, then we can help them along this journey as well.
Because our bodies ultimately haven't caught up with the technology just yet. Barry Lee Cummings, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate your insights and all of your messages as well. We got a message from a 10-year-old saying, my mother keeps a screen time limit on me, but not on herself. Maybe there needs to be a policy in your home. And a comment here, 4001, saying, with older kids, VR can be a great tool for learning, activity, motor skills, etc. You can find out more about the work that Beat the Cyberbully do on their website, from resources to visits, consultations as well.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Massive smile on my face this afternoon. Very happy to announce we have got a guest in the studio, our first for nearly 2 years. The doctor is in the house and he is literally right here, joined by Dr. Harun Mann. He's a trauma and orthopaedic surgeon, graduated both in the UK, fellowship trained in the States. If you've got any questions for him, get in touch with us. It's 4001. The app is there. You can send photos. Dr. Mann works in the NHS Central London at the world-renowned Royal Free London Hospital, an honorary senior lecturer and associate professor at UCL Medical School. He also teaches undergraduates, postgrads, and he travels between London and obviously here. He's got clinic at Zia Medical Centre. Now, we are talking today, obviously, about lower limb, where he's something he's a bit of an expert in, sports injuries, diabetic feet, ankle conditions as well. He also participates in humanitarian work, and we are lucky enough to have his brains to pick for the next hour. Doctor, so nice to have you with us. How are you?
Helen, it's fantastic to be back.
Yay.
And it's so nice. Thank you so much for getting me back in.
Absolute pleasure. As I said, we're really lucky to have stolen you away from Zia for this afternoon. 4001 to get in touch. Now, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your experiences as a surgeon over the course of the last couple of years. You've come to Dubai, you know, briefly, but what's happening back in the UK in terms of backlog, and what's the situation there? Because we've been so lucky here in Dubai that really it has been business as usual for really the vast majority of the time.
Well, we lost a lot of elective surgery hours and time and days and months, in fact. And I, to be honest with you, I stopped operating for almost the best part of 6 months in terms of my elective practice. Mm-hmm. Trauma, of course, we did and continued. But the pandemic has meant that things are slower. We have to have lots of gaps between particular cases, and the turnaround time between cases is significantly reduced. So therefore, the capacity that we were working pre-pandemic is significantly reduced. But there are lots and lots of factors. I mean, it's not just about patient factors. It's hospital factors. It's about safety factors. People are sometimes reluctant to come in and have surgery. And we really did struggle with getting back up and running. But we are now back up, probably to about 70% where we were. Having said that, we are probably circa 5 million cases that are waiting on our NHS waiting lists, and there's a lot of backlog. So there's a fairly uphill struggle ahead of us.
Oh, goodness. As I said, we've been really lucky here. And I say this across the board, you know, when you've got health insurance, in the case of you need to see a neurologist, oh, look, you can have an appointment in half an hour. You just need to wait here. You know, whereas we think about referrals, we think about waiting times in other parts of the world. So I want to ask you a little bit from your point of view, and it might be completely unrelated to you as a kind of trauma, sports injury, lower limb specialist. Have you seen any kind of long COVID cases that you think relate to your specialty?
I mean, I have patients who come and see me with long COVID, but not per se as a result of the trauma and surgery. But in particular, I do see patients who've come in and said they're still fatigued having had COVID. And interestingly, my practice is about 20% pediatric and adolescent. It's been quite surprising that I've seen a number of children or adolescents from 14 to 17 who've been suffering actually with long COVID.
Interesting.
And symptoms of long COVID. And these, one in particular, I mean, she runs 50 kilometers a week. So she's not your jobbing athlete. She's actually a hardcore endurance runner. And for her to say that she can't barely walk 100 yards and she's exhausted after 2 days of school is something.
That's really sad, really, really sad. And I wanted to turn our attentions a little bit to pediatrics, which is the kind of the focus of this afternoon. After school activities are back on here, PE and swimming, a lot of our kids getting active again. Short of wrapping them in cotton wool, Dr. Mann, what can we do to kind of protect them in certain situations, or even certain sports, would you say, so they're not having to come and see a doctor such as you in an ideal world?
I mean, it's been a huge, difficult area for schools to deal with over the last 12 months and last 18 months. Full contact sports is a controversial area, and there are parents who are concerned that, you know, my son or daughter are going back to full contact sports. I think, again, we can't wrap people up in cotton wool, but we have to be sensible. If there are people who've got symptoms, I think the lateral flow testing of children and at school, I think, is absolutely crucial and really important. And then isolation and just sort of those classes being in their own bubbles almost to be able to protect. But I think where you're playing full contact sport, you can't really get away from it.
What about protecting them from bone injuries as well? Are there any sports that you wouldn't let your children participate in?
Well, I think we've been here before.
We talked trampolining. That's right.
I think
if I recall, I'd just bought a trampoline. Devastated.
Well, believe it or not, actually, during the lockdown, lots of kids were stuck at home. And we did see quite a few trampoline injuries, I must say, because kids are at home. What else are they going to do? Trampoline.
Parents are working, kind of semi-supervising.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Joining us live in the studio is Dr. Haroon Mann. He's a trauma and orthopaedic surgeon, graduated both in the UK, fellowship trained in the USA. He works at the NHS and also here in Dubai. He's currently visiting and you can find him at Zia. It is on Beach Road in Jumeirah. And you're a busy man. I hope you've had a coffee, sir, because I've got lots of questions. Najib has been in touch saying, my daughter's friend kicked her while messing around on Friday and the knee bent at a strange angle. She felt a pop and fell to the ground. Went to bed with some painkillers, got to sleep, but woke up yesterday and the pain was worse, plus swelling. Stairs are a big problem. Applied rice, not the food, but the rest, ice, compression, elevation, and some gentle movement. But she's woken this morning and a lot of pain. Can't straighten or bend without much pain. Can bear weight if the knee is a slight bend, but otherwise pain. What should we do?
Well, it sounds to me like she's had a patella subluxation. It's popped in and popped out again. If it's really swollen and really tender, then she ought to be seen by somebody. And I am available in clinic this evening or tomorrow. It's a very, very common condition. I see it all the time in my trauma clinics.
It happened to me about six times.
Yeah. So the knee, momentarily, she's bent the knee patella's popped out outside laterally and it's gone back in. And that can be really painful. Mm-hmm. And in severe cases, you can tear some of the structures, the soft tissue structures, and you can also sometimes chip a piece of cartilage.
Which is exactly what happened to me. So I had to have an arthroscopy to remove a bit of bone that was just merrily travelling around my knee for too long. So if Najiba takes her daughter to a doctor, you know, A&E or specialist straight away such as yourself, is it a case of having an x-ray examination? What could they expect?
It depends on the swelling. It depends on the mechanism of injury and the degree degree of trauma and how angry the knee is. Mm-hmm. If it's really angry and upset, then clearly she may have taken a chip off. If it's not, and it's just a sort of a swollen knee, then I would suggest that she gets herself in to see a physiotherapist, and she can purchase one of those simple knee supports mm-hmm. and use some crutches. And again, as you said, RICE, rest, ice, compression, elevation. Not basmati.
You eat it while you do that. But these, you know, these kids as well, it's hard to keep them still. We are
family. Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Joining us in studio is Dr. Haroon Mann. He's a trauma and orthopaedic surgeon. Graduated in the UK, did his fellowship trained in the US. Going to the text line, you're a popular man, doctor. A question here from Misha saying, my daughter's six. I bought her a pair of cheaper shoes to have for school and noticed the other day that the inner part of the heel on her right foot has worn down considerably and much more than the other side. I have hypermobility, which is one of the reasons I got SPD in pregnancy. My daughter also is hypermobile and was born with a clicky hip on the right side. She does have flat feet and spent most of her toddler years and ages 3 to 4 in support of trainers that helped her walking. But should we be concerned?
Well, unless it's causing her pain and discomfort, or she is unable to run and participate in sports because she's got pain in the knees. That's typical what would happen to somebody who has hypermobility and flat feet, that they would wear out on the inner mm-hmm. aspect of the heel. I think given that she is demonstrating that so quickly that she's wearing out on the inner side, she should be assessed, I think, by a podiatrist. I work very closely with a podiatrist actually here in Dubai. And they can do various things like gait analysis and really see how she's walking on a treadmill or walking along a digitalized mat and actually look at her footprints to see what she's doing.
So and that would look at the pressure points and where the foot is striking and all that?
Absolutely. And okay. You could see how the hips are moving, what the spine is doing, what the shoulders are doing, and you look at it in almost 3D. When I'm looking, actually, I can do through my assessment, I do an assessment in 3D. I look at them in the coronal plane, which is the frontal plane, the front-to-back plane, and the axillary plane, and I try and sort of get a three-dimensional view of what's happening where. Is it coming from the hips, the knees, or is it coming from the foot and ankle, or even sometimes is it coming from a scoliosis in somebody who's hypermobile and they've got unequal leg lengths? So there's a lot to look at.
Okay, really hope that helps. So definitely worth a bit of further investigation. Poor Noor. Noor, my heart goes out to you. It really does. Noor's been in touch on 4001 saying, my 13-month-old son fell down a full flight of stairs. Turns out he's got a broken ankle, is now in plaster. They've said I mustn't let him rest on this leg, but it's virtually impossible. He wants to crawl and stand against things. Is it really possible to stop a child using a leg to stand up? And what can we do to speed up the healing? Oh, poor little soul.
I know, 13 months, that's really small.
And the frustration those kids get at that age, because they can't articulate, you know, pain or indeed wanting to be able to do certain things and being restricted by something that, you know, like, what is this thing on my leg?
It's really common. I mean, a fracture, I presume it's the tibia that she's referring to, or the distal tibia. I'm not sure it's the ankle per se, but I haven't seen the x-rays. But toddlers do get fractures, and we call them actually toddler's fractures.
How do they feel? Do they heal faster than adult fractures?
They do. All they need is a cast, and a cast for about 2, maybe 3 weeks, depending on the configuration of the fracture. And they chuck out callus. They heal so quick.
Okay, all right. And what about speeding up the healing? Is there anything you'd recommend anyone who might have suffered some kind of trauma that they include in their diet or supplementation that, you know, actually that has shown either anecdotally through you and your years as a specialist or that you've read research-wise?
I don't suspect there'll be a nutritional issue in Dubai. The food is so good here, I must say.
Too good. Way too good.
The food is fantastic here. I highly like it. But of course, nutritional deficiencies do lead to poor bone healing, as do other health conditions. So I'd say probably not, as long as they're getting plenty of sunshine and vitamin D does help. Mm. But I think children heal so quick, so I wouldn't say that they necessarily need supplements.
Okay, what about us as grown-ups? as our bones get more rickety, Dr. Mann, is there anything we should be including just to almost preventative? We want to stay on the right side of health rather than treating pain down the line.
Well, I think vitamin D deficiency is one of those global pandemic. Mm-hmm. Pardon the word pandemic, but it's a global issue. And vitamin D has been highlighted in numerous journals and articles and research studies to show that it does reduce bone healing. So vitamin D, I think, is primarily an issue. But diabetes, smoking, these are all things that actually work against bone healing. Mm-hmm. And so diabetic control is paramount. So if you do have an infection or a broken bone, making sure that your diabetic control is meticulous is super important.
What about, I don't want to say pre-existing conditions, but kind of nature? Are some people perhaps more prone to fragile, you know, being a bit more fragile to breaking and fracturing bones just because of their genetics?
There are. There are conditions called osteogenesis imperfecta, for example. And those conditions do make patients or children or adolescents more susceptible to fracturing bones from very limited, even stepping off a chair or step.
Oh, goodness. Okay. Going to the text line, 4001, Dr. Hoodman was joining us in the studio until 4 o'clock, and I've got lots of questions to get through, so we're gonna do our best here. No name on this one, and it comes back to trampolines, saying, our daughter is 8 and has been asking for a trampoline for 2 years. I've always said no due to the injury aspect, but then I've come across spring-free trampolines. They claim to have eliminated 90% of the injuries children have had, so I've decided maybe I was being overcautious. I should let her have one. I know plenty of children have them with no injuries, etc., but I ordered one last night and then decided it wasn't a good idea. The lady on the phone wanted to know why I wanted to cancel, so I explained. She said there was a lot of misinformation online about trampolines and really did the hard sell. Would love an expert's opinion. Am I being a killjoy? Am I being overcautious? Right, doctor, I want to hear it as well. We just moved house and our trampoline was so raggedy and gross, I couldn't face bringing it with us. So I'm kind of hoping that I've done the right thing by sheer laziness.
Well, I'm not a trampoline expert, but I do see a lot of trampoline injuries.
And what causes them exactly? What is the movement or the landing that can be problematic?
In my experience, when I've taken a history from a patient with a trampoline injury, what generally happens is that it's that recoil off the trampoline that really sends you back
up
against gravity. And that recoil, if your muscles are not tense or the appropriate helping you to protect yourself, that can then lead to an inappropriate force being transmitted into the bone.
Mm-hmm.
Plus you're landing as well. So if you're landing awkwardly, you can land with, you know, your arm fully stretched out. I had a young girl, 13-year-old, who was actually almost a semi-professional trampolinist, and she was having lessons for many, many years. And both her bones in the forearm fractured. So I think it's difficult. And when you're on trampoline, people get excited, and then there's other people on trampolines with you.
Everyone's showing off a little bit, especially if there's birthday cake at a party. Yeah. The sugar kicks in, the risk factors increase.
And I think what happens also is when there's more than one person on a trampoline,
mm-hmm.
the unevenness you can't predict,
yes.
And that's when injuries occur.
Okay, let us know, guys. Any questions for Dr. Mann? He's with us until 4 o'clock. We are looking at pediatrics, which, as he said, takes about 20% of his time and clients, but we can absolutely help you grown-ups as well. A message here saying, I had a ruptured disc that hit my spine. They removed Q11, Q2? I don't know.
T11?
I don't know. But 5 years later, I still have major lower back pain, even if I sit for a short period. Tried physio a few times, no long-term success. Have you got any other suggestions? I want to be able to run again. Oh, that's hard for people. It really is. I'd love an excuse not to do exercise, to be completely honest. It's not true.
I'm sure that's not true.
No, it's not true.
Yeah. it's a difficult question to answer in 30 seconds. I mean, that is a really complicated question. The spinal surgery and post-spinal surgery, we know the results. If she had a disc, obviously they removed it to alleviate the pressure on the nerves, and that may have taken away the pain. But then there's lots of scarring and lots of other causes why you can get pain after that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a simple answer, but I think she's got to maintain her core stability, do lots of stretching, Pilates, yoga, keep herself mobile. If she finds that swimming helps, then swimming. But really keeping that the muscles surrounding her core strong, supple, and supportive. And then if there are any other reasons why the pain is there, for example, arthritis in the facet joints, maybe an injection or two can help alleviate that.
Okay. Message here saying, just wondered if you can recommend a good podiatrist. 40, I've got pain in my right heel. I think it's to do with the way I walk, maybe my posture. Can you point me in the right direction? I like the sound of that 3D machine he mentioned. So Dr. Man is with us as Zia, but you have a podiatrist there as well.
We've got a fantastic podiatrist. Her name is Maria Mangaki. She works with me very closely. She's amazing at gait analysis and with orthotics. She has them custom made and computer-aided design and computer-aided manufacture, so they're really good. And she can tweak them a little bit to adjust them because some of them need fine-tuning. Mm-hmm. I would strongly recommend her. She's at Zia Medical Centre.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
The doctor is in the house, free clinic for you this afternoon as we talk children's health. And joining us live in the studio, my first guest for about 2 years, I'm so delighted, is Dr. Haroon Mann. He is a trauma and orthopaedic surgeon. He works with children all the way through the years, graduated both in the UK as well and fellowship trained in the States. And he works full time with the NHS in central London, teaches undergrads and postgraduates as well, and travels between London and here. And he's got clinic at Zia Medical Centre, that's Beach Road in Jumeirah. Dr. Mann, a question here saying, we've got my son is 15 years old. He's got clicking joints in his knees and feet, but no hypermobility. Should we be concerned and how to reduce them? What is this about clicking joints? My husband clicks his knuckles. I find it. Is he doing any damage? And should this parent be worried about this teen?
Not particularly. I mean, if he has clicking joints, we all have clicking, snapping joints where they click and snap, and for various reasons. As long as it's not painful or causing him discomfort or there's any swelling, I don't think there's anything pathological per se, and I wouldn't worry about it. It's when that clicking becomes painful clicking, mm-hmm. and snapping. That people click for all various reasons. We've got multiple joints in the human body, and they're surrounded by ligaments, tendons, and sometimes those ligaments and tendons, they snap, and they sometimes...
Snap sounds awful.
I mean, snap as in a...
As in a sound rather than an action.
Correct.
Okay, yeah. Okay. It's very different than having clicking joints to kind of gravelly joints, which is what I had after lots of knee issues, where it felt like there was gravel inside. Does that make sense? Like, yeah. Crunchy rather than clicky.
Well, it's interesting you say that. It's sometimes the fluid within the knee, if you have a slight swelling of the knee, that can cause it like almost like a squeak in the knee. And the grating you commonly find in osteoarthritis.
That's what I have. I went for this executive well woman check and they're like, oh, this is all great. You know, you've got the metabolic rate of a 24-year-old and the knees of an 84-year-old.
I don't think so.
I'll show you the x-rays. Message here from Alex saying, I've got an issue with shin splints. Been running for about 2 years. Tried taking month-long breaks, ramping up slowly, warming up. Still after 30 minutes getting shin splints. What should I look into? What are shin splints exactly? Because they are excruciating.
Well, shin splints are a colloquial term, mm-hmm. for... Stress, basically a stress fracture or stress-induced injury to a bone, and they commonly occur around the shin. And it's on the medial aspect of the shin commonly where they occur, because the way the forces are directed through the human body. So as we stand, gravity hits the center of our head, and it comes to the center of our chest, and it goes to the center of our hips and knees and foot and ankle. If you're loading that bone or loading that limb in a certain way, then the forces are applied in a certain area. And if excessive forces are applied in that area, you get stress, mm-hmm. and strain. And that leads to pain and inflammation and sometimes a fracture.
Is this something that's a done deal? You know, you get shin splints and no matter what technique you try, this is your destiny? Or is it a case of tweaks with, you know, a running coach, for example, who can teach you ways of, you know, foot striking or pacing or... Whatever runners do. I'm not a runner.
Yeah, me neither. yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's exactly about that. It's biomechanics. So sometimes it's the biomechanics of a patient, or sometimes they have a slight bow to the tibia, mm-hmm. and that's just the way they are physiologically. It's not abnormal. It's just within the spectrum of the way they are. And therefore, they just need to tweak the way they run, the type of sneaker that they're going to use. It's really important to have the sneaker assessed properly. Sometimes they overpronate, sometimes they underpronate, and therefore their foot is in or out too much. sometimes they're just not running well, or sometimes there's a muscle group that's not really well produced. For example, the glutes are not working.
Got to activate the glutes.
Yeah.
Got to bring in the booty. But yeah, hope that helps. This is what we were saying on Kilimanjaro. I was like, oh, I'm worried about my knees. You need to activate the glutes.
Absolutely right. And that's what I was going to ask you there, actually.
Yeah.
Did you do lots of glutes before you went?
Loads and loads of quads around my knees. Yeah. Absolutely loads. Yeah. Glad it's over, to be honest. A message here saying, I miss the name of the orthopaedic surgeon at Zia. It is Dr. Haroon Mann. That's M-A-N-N. How long are you in town for, sir?
I'm here till Friday.
Busy, booked up?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
A few operations.
Going to have to be fast. And a question here, last one. This is from Tim saying, our 9-month-old has just started walking. Oh my goodness, that's my nightmare realised. With my first one, I was like, race towards the milestone, second child. If you could just not walk, that would be amazing. Her legs are very bandy. Should we be worried about that? So I guess he means where, you know, little ones where their legs kind of bow out.
Yeah.
What does Tim and his wife presumably need to be aware of?
I see that all the time.
Do you really?
Oh, I see a lot. A lot of it's to do with the way the fetus sits within the uterus and within the pelvis.
Mm-hmm.
They're literally folded up. I'm not sure people can't see me on air, but they're folded up. The legs are folded in that way. And in fact, I saw a patient about 2 weeks ago and the parents were concerned. This baby was literally 2 weeks old. And I positioned the baby as it was and it would have been within the uterus. And a mum was amazed. They thought the child had club feet. And I showed them how the position of molding, mm-hmm. it had been molded. And I said, look, the baby's going to unfold.
Furl, yeah.
You know,
like a little prawn just unfurled.
It's going to unfold. And the limbs will come out straight, and that it can be a little bit concerning to parents and patients. Yeah,
especially when it is, you know, it's your first. You've got no point of comparison.
Yeah.
And then you start Googling.
Yeah,
never Dr. Google.
And if that persists, then obviously into adolescence, then obviously clearly it's something that needs to be seen. But there are many other causes that I don't want to go into, but at a couple of weeks old, it's nothing to be concerned about.
Okay. Doctor, thank you so much for your time. We've run out of time. We have run out of questions. So if you do want to catch Dr. Mann, he is there at Zia, that's Z-I-A, on Beach Road. And any plans to come back to Dubai in the next few months?
Always.
Yay. Fantastic. Thank you so much again. An absolute pleasure to have you in the studio. Can't thank you enough. And really,
thanks,
really appreciate your insights. It's been hugely useful just to kind of lift the lid on how our free clinics work on the show. Dr. Mann is not briefed on any of the topics. Obviously, your messages are coming in real life. They really are that good.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Family matters indeed, and we're meeting a family very, very soon. October is Down Syndrome Awareness Month. This is a chance, of course, to spread awareness, to educate, advocacy, and talk about inclusion throughout the community. Down Syndrome, sometimes called Down's Syndrome, is a condition in which a child is born with an extra copy of the 21st chromosome, hence its other name, trisomy 21, and this causes physical and developmental delays, and also some very wonderful upsides as well. And according to statistics from the United Nations, the estimated incidence of Down Syndrome is between 1 in 1,000 and 1 in 1,100 live births worldwide. And each year, approximately 3,000 to 5,000 children are born with this. So we're joined now by UA mum and dad, Wada and Nasser Al-Awa, and their son Dahi has Down syndrome. He is in grade 10. They're going to be speaking about their experience as a family and living with Down syndrome. And if you want to get in touch with your experiences, we'd love to hear from you too on 4001. How are you, Nasser and Wada?
Hello. Hi, Helen.
Great to have you with us. And thank you again for sharing your time and your experiences and understanding that Dubai Eye is a platform for all, you know, really here to hear everybody's story and to educate everyone as far as possible. I'd like to start with you, Wada. And you decided to quit your job and take care of Dahi full time. Why did you feel you needed to make that decision? Can you tell us about it?
Actually, it was a big challenge. I need to take full care of Dahi from all therapies, educational therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy, and physiotherapy, and to let him gain as much education as we can to give him any care and love.
And this sounds like a full-time job in itself, as you say, managing his schedule, you know, obviously the social side, but also the therapies involved and education too. Tell us a little bit about when you received the diagnosis for Dahi. What were your initial thoughts, and how has the experience been different perhaps to what you expected as a mother?
Actually, at the beginning, it was a big shock. There is somehow refuse. But with the support of my husband, we cooperate together, we bond. We got a lot of information from different associations online and from outside, abroad, from UK, from Canada, from Glasgow.
And you are part of the Gulf Disability Society. And I'm curious, Nasser, and as a father and member of society, you know, you want to change the narrative around Down syndrome. What do you think that current narrative is, and what do you think needs to change?
First of all, thank you for hosting us in Dubai Eye 103.8.
You're very welcome.
The acceptance is the most important thing for both sides, the parents, caregivers, and as well the society. Some parents deal with this with a denial and refusal and keeping them hide it in some homes, not taking them out, feeling ashamed of having them. And actually it's the opposite. They are a gift. We are gifted to have this superhero, Dahi, Emirati superhero. And you cannot believe the size of joy and happiness he's providing for us in home or wherever we go. And the society, you know, sometimes with reason or without reason, with intention or without intention, they just are afraid to communicate them. They think that they are maybe aggressive, maybe they will not accept it. It's misunderstanding, only not more. I think people should be educated more. And we were lucky to have a very perfect, decent school, which Dahi thinks it's the school is his second family and his second home as well.
That's wonderful. And as you say, Dahi's in a mainstream school. Can I ask you, Wata, how is school going?
Very well, because as we practice and with him since he's young, since his child, 5 months old, now he loves learning. He's more concentrating. He can work for 5 hours continuously. He's so active.
That's wonderful.
He likes to accept the challenge and always to prove for us that he can give more than our expectation. And whenever he's sick, we ask him to stay at home, don't go to school. He would like to go. Not to stay.
Dahi's surprising you in the best way every single day, it sounds like, Nasser. What do you think are some of the... Sorry.
He's enjoying having friends as his siblings.
So school, it sounds like, has become such an important place. We're going to be talking about education after 4:30. But I wondered, Nasser, what do you think are some of the misconceptions about Down syndrome that maybe people have said to your face or you've read about that prevent children like Dahi having a happy life or not being as included as you would like?
The misunderstanding is that some people not try to learn about them, not to have more education or information about them. So they are just looking something else, something not normal, something is abnormal. But at the end, they are very friendly, very lovely persons and very happy and joyful people.
We're going to speak to Dahi next. I'm really excited to find out a little bit about school and what he enjoys about it. And also, what does the future hold? What does he aspire to become?
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
And joined by a family right now. We are marking Down Syndrome Awareness Month. It's a chance, of course, to spread awareness, education, clear up misconceptions and talk about the importance of inclusion throughout the community. And joining us on Microsoft Teams, we have got Mum and Dad, Wada and Nasa Alawa, and their son, Dahi, who has Down Syndrome. He's in grade 10. Dahi, thank you so much for being with us. Tell us, where do you go to school?
I'm going to again Belton Academy VSS.
Your dad was saying how much you love school and even want to go when you're not feeling very well, Dahi. What is it that you enjoy about school?
I like school for meeting people, having friends, and learning.
It's so wonderful, Wada, that you were talking about how, you know, part of that mainstream school, you know, part and that importance of inclusion. We're going to be talking about education after 12:30. And I just wondered, Nasa, if you were able to share a little bit about what your hopes and aspirations are for your son.
Yeah. I want him to be a first UAE citizen to graduate from the high school and from the secondary school, which it is high school. And I was thinking if there is a chances if he could go to a university to continue his study. So this is my demand request from my government, to see if there is any chance for Dahi to have a seat or chair in the university after he finished the high school, the secondary. Now he's 17. Which car you like, Dahi?
Nissan.
A Nissan. Which Nissan?
Which Nissan?
Nissan Fitek, he would like to
nice.
Drive this
one. So this is the plan, university and a bit of cruising down Beach Road. Good man. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story this afternoon. Really, really appreciate it.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is Sunday afternoon and we're talking education. In fact, in particular, special education needs. How do we ensure that children with Down syndrome get the education suitable for them? We are coming to the end of Down Syndrome Awareness Month, and joining us from the UK on the phone is Joanne Nolan from iAcademy, where she's the Special Education Needs Coordinator. Would you mind, Joanne, giving us a little bit of context and information for those of us who aren't aware? How do you believe, and how do studies show, that children, young people, even adults with Down syndrome, those students learn differently?
Well, I think one of the most important things to remember is that whether it's a child with Down syndrome or an adolescent with Down syndrome or an adult with Down syndrome, they're still people first. So one of the things I always want to be careful of is not to fall into the trap of making sweeping generalizations, because within Down syndrome, there's going to be a wide range of ability, and some children with Down syndrome are going to have other issues which make their profile more complex. So some of them are going to have greater health issues like cardiac issues. Some of them may have hearing problems and vision problems. It's very difficult to say that every single child with Down syndrome is going to have the same learning challenges. There are going to be lots of commonalities, mm-hmm. but there are going to be individual differences. It's very important to look at that individual child and get to know him or her first, and then address those needs in the classroom.
I think that is so important. And when we've discussed certain issues on the show, and it could be, you know, neurological issues or behavioural issues, and you know, we hear it time and time again, you know, you've met one child with autism, you've met one child with autism, you know, there's no definitive example of such. So I think that getting to know period is so crucial. Providing that person has had the training that they need. You know, we've talked previously about, you know, language delays and how we learn through language as well, speech clarity issues as well. What kind of training really goes into being able to work in a truly inclusive way behind the scenes?
I think that one of the most important things is that there's so many teachers and classroom assistants these days will have experience of seeing children on the spectrum in their classroom, because, of course, the rate of diagnosis is now so high. So you may have, in the UK, they're reckoning it's about 1 in 60, whereas for Down syndrome, it's about 1 in 1,000. So these days, many teachers and classroom assistants are not going to have the same experience. And I think what they have to learn is that the children with Down syndrome may have stronger receptive language than their expressive language. And that can be different from working with children on the spectrum who sometimes have echolalia and scripted language, which makes their expressive language appear stronger. But in fact, their receptive language can be weaker. Down syndrome children, it tends to be the opposite. They have stronger understanding of language, but may have difficulty acquiring vocabulary. Their speech clarity may be more difficult to understand. So I think that teachers and classroom assistants need to be very aware of that, so they can help build up the language, build up the vocabulary, so they can hook on to the knowledge.
That must be hugely frustrating for those students, in terms of, as you say, having a great level of understanding, but perhaps not being able to express themselves as well as they'd like to.
Exactly. It's very frustrating. And you then think of the number of times you may experience failure. So then if you think that, you know, a child with learning difficulties and language difficulties is going to have many more experiences of failure, and they're going to need much more repetition of the same thing again and again in order to secure that learning. So therefore, on the part of the adult, whether it's a teacher or a parent, the learning partner, there's so much more of an onus on keeping that learning fresh and engaging and fun, because otherwise the child with Down syndrome could just, you know, disengage and lose interest. Because why would you want to keep on doing the same thing again and again?
Exactly.
It just gets frustrating.
So in terms of staying with that frustration, what are some of the behaviours that can be born out of that?
Well, a lot of it is going to be just disengagement. You know, there's a question of keeping a child with Down syndrome motivated to learn. There's quite a lot of research on this, but sometimes that the child may disengage, even though they may have the skills to be able to perform the task, but they just, you know, it's either I don't want to, I can't be bothered, I've lost interest. You've got to be able to make it much more engaging, and that bond then between the teacher and the child becomes much more important. Not having low expectations, expecting that the child will be able to do it with support and with patience and time and empathy, rather than just saying, oh, he can't do it. Because those low expectations are generally not fair. You know, they can, with support, keep learning, but they may need a lot more repeated practice and multi-sensory experiences and keeping it, you know, engaging and fresh, as I said.
What about visual learning? What role does that play?
Absolutely vital. You know, children with Down syndrome are more visual learners. That's how they're going to relate to the world. That, you know, from that very early sense of babies where you reach out and touch things, that's going to be delayed for a child with Down syndrome because they may have weak fine motor skills and gross motor skills. But we still eventually engage with the world, you know, through reaching and touching. So when it comes to learning new vocabulary, you're going to have to touch the object first, a concrete object rather than something abstract, because that's going to be their real experience of the world. So that's even more important for a child with Down syndrome than, you know, some other learners who may have stronger auditory learning and auditory memory.
And what about how parents, you know, do you feel like there's enough support for parents of children with Down syndrome to understand what they can do at home to prepare children for school or for nursery, for higher education, and really be working in parallel with the education system?
I think this is where the role of early intervention is so key, because those first, you know, 0 to 3, those years are so vitally important to be engaged with the child's paediatrician to get recommendations for occupational therapy and speech therapy, because it really does take a team to build up those early learning skills, which will then put the child in a better position when they first go to nursery. Because you've got the very basic things like self-help, you know, putting on your jacket or putting on shoes or toileting skills. All of these things are very important, and it's going to make those first years in kindergarten and school easier if they have been supported at home. And, you know, with all the will in the world, therapists don't have enough time with a child. So therefore, the parent has to learn from their therapist, whether it's speech therapy or occupational therapy or whatever, so that these skills can be practiced consistently at home to give them more of a chance of success.
Can I ask, Joanne, to any parents listening today who want to talk to their, and I hate to use the word normal, but let's say neurotypical children, about maybe there's a child in their school or their class who has Down syndrome, about the importance of inclusion and, you know, peer support, relationships and friendships?
I think this is where, you know, children with Down syndrome are such wonderful candidates for inclusion. All children with special needs should be included, but children with Down syndrome are more social than, say, a child with autism, and therefore they can benefit so much more from being in a group situation, from being buddied up with a stronger peer in a group project. And, you know, I think it's so important for them. At the end of the day, inclusion is about the child's experience of inclusion. So how do you feel included? So I think that children have to learn acceptance, and they're only going to do that by having children in the classroom with them, so they get to know them as a friend. And then later on in life, there's nothing surprising. Whereas years ago, you know, so many of these children were kept away. And I think that's why inclusion today, particularly in Dubai, is really opening up, and there's so many more opportunities for children with Down syndrome to be included in the mainstream classroom.
Joanne, if you could wave a magic wand and change something, whether that is attitude or understanding or, you know, the way schools operate, what would you like to see in Dubai when it comes to inclusion in the next 5 years or so?
That's a really big question. I think that the continued drive towards inclusion is really important. But I do think that my magic wand would be to ensure that the child's experience comes first. You know, that we have to, you know, remember that, you know, they say about inclusion, it's like being invited to the party and then being asked to dance. I think for a child with Down syndrome, it's not just being invited to dance, it's also being part of the decoration committee to decide what's going up on the walls and what music could be played. It's so much more integral than just a passive. Being invited in is being an active participant. And I think that when we start out creating opportunities for children with special needs and Down syndrome to be actively included, that's when I would say the magic wand has worked.
Well, you've just given me goosebumps. And this doesn't sound like a strange question, but in terms of bits of equipment and kit that parents who may have children or students with Down syndrome might find useful, is there anything that you found over the years that can be great for, you know, learning tools or, you know, just in terms of expression? You talked about sensory equipment earlier. Is there anything that people should have on their shopping list?
I think they should definitely have soft pencil grips. You know, you can buy these easily in many of the shops in Dubai. It's just something to make the pencil feel like a better ergonomic grip, something that's soft, that you can find different types. And later on, keyboard skills are really important. So finding a keyboard which is child-friendly and a special mouse which the child can manipulate. So I think that, you know, introducing keyboarding when the child is able for it is a really good investment.
Joanne, thank you so much for your time and insights today. You speak so beautifully, and it's a real honour to think about what, you know, hear your thoughts on what could be. Joanne, thank you so much. Really, really valuable information today, and I hope it's made us all think whether we are parents of children with Down syndrome or we just want to have more inclusion, as we all should, in our schools here in Dubai. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much indeed.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune in to Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.